It's been decades since Brown versus Board of Education ruled that in the classroom, separate but equal is inherently unequal. And integrated schools became the law of the land. Technically, anyway. We've all heard the story of white flight and the parallel story of how public schools became segregated not by law but by other things, like real estate with your address determining which public school your kids could attend, or money with the size of your bank account determining whether private school would be an option. In Kansas City, Missouri, the public schools are seeing a transformation, with district schools regaining accreditation, white families staying in the city instead of moving sort of inevitably to the suburbs, and a whole slew of charters entering the mix. But Kansas City's classrooms still look segregated. KCUR's Kyle Palmer hosted a live taping of his education podcast, No Wrong Answers, and he asked the newish superintendent, Mark Bedell, if he and his staff were thinking about the racial breakdown of Kansas City, Missouri's schools. Here's what he said.
Well, yeah, we are. And I think we've been very explicit around the fact that we are a very segregated school system. We do not have a tremendous amount of diversity in some of our schools. Probably the most diverse school that we may have is a Border Star. I think there's a fair distribution of different ethnicities being served there. Lincoln, probably, when you just think about children of color, it's probably around 88% or so, and then we probably have another 12% that are white that reside within that building. But for the most part, most of our schools that tend to be neighborhood schools, that we tip around 80 to 85 to 90% African-American children. And I'll be very clear with everybody in here, and I've been very clear with our Board of Education. We're just not going to participate in anything that's going to further perpetuate the segregation that I've inherited as a superintendent.
So it sounds like diversity is still a goal for Mark Bedell and his staff. But is it a goal everyone shares? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 with your perspective. Let's start this conversation with Ellie Moxley. She's the education reporter here at KCUR. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Gina.
So Mark Bedell says he's not going to perpetuate the segregation he inherited in the Kansas City, Missouri public schools. Can you help us understand that comment a little better?
Well, in terms of the inherited piece, I think that part's obvious. You know, like you mentioned before, white flight is a real thing in this city. It's been going on since the 60s. And, you know, each successive decade, the racial balance has tipped towards students of color. And, you know, at this point, the district is about 50 to 60% Black, about 20 to 30% Latino. And, you know, and that does not necessarily reflect the demographics of our city. In terms of, you know, he's not going to perpetuate segregation, one of the things I've heard a lot from the district in the last few months is that they're really concerned about the education of the kids they have now. They are really concerned with making sure that the students that are currently going to Kansas City public schools are getting a great education. They want to, you know, ditch that reputation of a school district, you know, that's struggling, a district in turmoil, and they want to make sure that those kids are leaving their school district ready to succeed in life. And I think they want to improve diversity. They would welcome, you know, more white families, more folks that have traditionally opted out of the public schools in the city to come back to them, but they aren't willing to maybe make some of the they aren't willing to make moves that would do anything that would jeopardize the kids that are there now. They want to add students without, you know, necessarily taking anything away from the kids that they're currently serving.
Is there a perception that reaching out for people who have not participated in public education in the urban part of the city traditionally, is there a sense that that would in some way possibly harm the current students?
I think the real kind of question here is going back to, you know, the 80s and the 90s when Kansas City was talking about its magnet program and talking about, you know, court-ordered desegregation and the way that the district went about it at the time. It was a pretty unusual solution. There were a lot of these deseg cases in big cities like Kansas City, but But the remedy was very interesting in Kansas City because they said, you know, we should build these schools with a lot of amenities and that will attract white families back. The focus became very much on the white families and bringing them into the district and not necessarily on the kids that were there and on serving those kids well.
So the amenities in those buildings weren't necessarily, if you were just looking at the kids in the district, like what they needed most.
Yes, they were really geared towards, like, for example, the one that people always talks about is the Central Academy of Excellence Center High School. You know, they built this great gym, they built these world-class athletic facilities, and then the building sat not empty, but it wasn't at capacity for years because there were rules that said, oh, the balance has to be a certain way. So if they couldn't attract, you know, white kids from the suburbs to go to these schools, then kids from the district that were already there weren't getting to take advantage of it. So I think that's what Bedell means, is he doesn't want to go back to that, you know, 30 years ago when, you know, we tried integration and we really tried to recruit white families to come to Kansas City public schools. But in the end, what we did probably really hurt a lot of black children.
This is something people talk a lot about in their own circles, just race and education. But you have the unique experience of talking to people in lots of communities about race and education. What are some of the differences you hear from one community to another?
Well, I actually want to start with the thing that I hear from all communities, which is they want their kid to get a great education. They want good quality schools for their kids. You know, I think one of the things that I think is interesting is you hear a lot about integration and diversity and you know, what can we do to maybe make our schools reflect the demographics of our city more, you know, from especially white families. What I hear a lot of the times from black and Latino families is they just want good schools. They're less concerned about what the racial makeup of the school is, as long as they're sending their kids to a good school. And, you know, and I think that makes sense. You know, I think that there's maybe a lack of trust in those communities that, you know, about the intentions of the folks that are, you know, talking about diversity and, you know, diverse by design. They just want to focus on making sure their kids get a great education. On the other side, I mean, I think that's what white families want too. And I think that there are a lot of white parents that are thinking about these issues and thinking not just about what's good for their children, but trying to think about what's good for, you know, the city as a whole and for youth as a whole in Kansas City.
There's this phrase, you just used it, diverse by design. It's being used in education circles, but it's new to me since you mentioned it. And I think it does get at a lot of the tensions here. Can you explain what diverse by design means?
You know, diverse by the design is the idea that we can create schools that do reflect the demographics of a community that are very intentionally designed to appeal to black families, to white families, to brown families, to, you know, everyone, and that we can do it in a way that, you know, kind of cultivates a balance of, you know, low-income kids, middle-income kids. You know, we know that it's good to have that kind of diversity in schools. I think the flip side of this is I think it's used in a lot of ways for people who this is their intention to create these schools. It's used in a positive way. It's used in a way like we are really thinking about these issues in a way that they haven't necessarily been thought about in education, you know, before. But on the other side, I think it goes back to kind of the district's position, which is that, you know, we don't want to commodify students of color. We don't want to say that, you know, oh, we can have 30% or we can have 50% or we can have, you know, because tipping points are real. There's a tipping point where white families, generally speaking, become uncomfortable. And it's probably different for every family. And we know that in some families, it's maybe 50%. There's research that suggests it's maybe closer to 30%. And that would mean, you know, a majority white school. And I don't think that that's going to happen realistically very soon in Kansas City public.
So this idea of possibly commodifying students of color, can you explain that a little bit more?
Right. I think that we need to make sure that when we're having these conversations, we're talking about what's best for all students. We're talking about what's best for kids. And I think that diversity can be a really good goal, but I think sometimes it gets talked about a little bit. It makes me uncomfortable when it is talked about in a way that, you know, suggests that about the benefits for white students. because I think really, especially in this conversation, and given, you know, the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education and the legacy of segregation, we really need to be talking about what's good for students of color and what's good, you know, for education.
Call 816-235-2888 with your story about public schools and race, either when you were growing up or now. What's shaping your decisions when you think about those things for your kids, for people's kids? 816-235-2888. I've been talking with KCUR's education reporter, Ellie Moxley. Now I want to talk to Gabriel Munoz. He's a local dad, and his kid is just 10 months old. But Gabriel, you are already thinking really hard about this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm a Kansas City, I guess you could say, native. I grew up in Independence, then moved to Liberty when I was about 10. And then once I got married, I came to the heart of downtown. I guess from a suburban, no offense, but perspective, it was like, okay, downtown is like a dangerous place. You don't want to be there. But having lived there for 4 years, I love it. And I really want to support. I feel invested. I feel invested in the city. And I that's something I want to help with if I can. And education is super important. I mean, if anyone has any kids, you really want them to get somewhere in life, and that has a lot to do with what they learn, and that has to do with education. So,
and of course, if your kid's 10 months old, this would be the time to be thinking about it, because, you know, the system that your child enters a few years from now is being shaped by decisions made right now.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, by the time we get there, when he's 16, if we try to make decisions then, things probably won't change. So yeah, absolutely. Like you're saying, making the changes now will definitely affect what happens in 10, 20 years. So
you walked me through your path moving from one community in the larger metro area to another. But what was your experience with education and race when you were in school?
Elementary school. Honestly, I don't remember too much of that because it was kind of a blur. But junior high, high school, that's really what stuck out to me. Predominantly white is, I guess, the Liberty area. It's a really good area. In fact, Liberty is known for its public school education. It's fantastic education, good facilities. Ellie brought up, excellent amenities for students as well. But because of, I guess, the demographic that I came up in education-wise, it was kind of hard to really express myself or who I am. I am Latino, like 100%. I got nothing else in me. It was hard to express that because you really felt like you needed to be like everybody else because everybody else was the same, I guess. There's two handfuls of Latinos in my school, and same with black students. But everybody else was white, and I mean, you kind of assimilate, I guess you could say.
And do you feel like you suffered as a person, or do you feel like specifically your education was harmed by that dynamic?
I wouldn't say my education was harmed, but because those are crucial years. Your teen years are extremely crucial. That's when you kind of like make or breaks you, you know? A lot of my time was spent maybe not so much on the academics, but trying to figure out who I was and like trying to fit in and trying to like, so am I, I know I have Hispanic parents who immigrated from South America, but, I go to the school where everyone like is a certain way. Everyone is a certain way. Do I become that, or do I express myself as a Latino? Do I own up to my like Hispanic heritage, or do I just like, you know, kind of disband that and be like, all right, I'm just white, you know?
Can you recall like a moment where that came to a head for you, where something that happened really just made you aware of feeling different?
I can't like pinpoint a specific moment. Maybe it's more so in like hindsight.
Yeah. It's
just looking back, because at the moment you're just kind of trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
But yeah, looking back for sure, it's you just kind of put it all together and you think, oh wow, like I didn't get to. It wasn't until after, and this is a little history about me, but I went to Mexico for 2 years 2011 to 2013, and that's where I like really grasped that part of me, and I was like, oh wow, this is like, I know Spanish, I can talk to people, and this is like, these are my people. It was after that, and kind of coming home, it's like, wow, that was, I never got to really express that or relate to that back in high school. So
when you think about your own child's education, how do you think about the importance of diversity in the classroom?
Super important. Extremely important, in my opinion. For a plethora of reasons, but mainly because it's kind of like the whole, when people say, like, if you travel around the world, you get more experiences, right? You get to experience more cultures, more people, and that makes you a more well-rounded person. You understand, you can empathize better with people, and that helps solve problems. Anywhere you go. I think if we can create that in schools, that would be fantastic, because you don't have to go, well, I mean, still go travel the world and experience other cultures, but it would be really nice to have that be part of the school system, and you can experience other cultures and other people without having to be like, oh, well, you need to be this way or you need to be that way because that's how it is, or, you know.
How do you respond to the notion that it's a privilege to think about diversity when you're thinking about your kids' education? I've heard people say that the idea that, you know, the ability to think about anything other than getting your kid the best education wherever you can get it is a privilege.
Could you say that one more time? Sorry,
just the idea that do you think that that this conversation is one that everyone feels like they even have the sort of access to?
You know, that is a good question, and I don't know. I feel like everyone's in a different part of life, and you're trying to get, maybe you're trying to surmount certain obstacles, and maybe that's not at the forefront of everyone's mind. Personally, I'm glad that's something I can think about and something that I can maybe plan for or help with or assist with. But yeah, I agree that not everyone, it's interesting, not everyone has access to that. I guess talking about diversity or even getting to a point where that is an issue in their life. But regardless, I still think it is important. It's like gravity. It's like, you maybe don't think about it, but it's there. We got to factor it in.
Susan Wilson is the Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion at UMKC, and she has some experience of her own as a mom and now as a grandmother. Susan, how do you hear the way people are talking about this stuff, first of all, in this room today?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, does this the issue of diversity in education, how do you feel like it's taking new turns, that people are talking about it in different ways than they used to?
Having a historical perspective, not really. I think it's always been the case that parents want the best education for their children. I think what's changed now is that there's more options, whereas when I went to school, I went to a predominantly black school and lived in a segregated community, and there weren't a lot of choices otherwise. And I just so happened to go to a school district in Pittsburgh, PA, that had excellent public education. I would put my public education up against a private school. But I think that's changed. I think public education, for a variety of reasons, including integration, the face of it has changed in terms of who goes to public schools now, because not only did you have white flight when integration happened, but you had black flight. You had black people moving to the suburbs to pursue what they thought was a better education for their children. Now, that pursuit of better education in white communities by black parents is fraught with issues, because there are many people who would say, well, my black child is not getting opportunities in white school districts like they would have in a black school district where you had, I know my teachers and mentors and principals, they took personal interest in kids, and you had opportunities to shine. Whereas if you're the only one or two black kids in a white school, getting access to student council and some of the other things can be a lot harder. And then you have the issue, I think, as Gabe mentioned, of identity. That I have a granddaughter who goes to a predominantly white school in Lee Summit. And I noticed how her language changed over time. And it was a bit unsettling because she came home talking about, we're going to the pool and we're going to school. And I'm like, well, that's not how we talk at home. Where are you picking this up? And because you don't want black children to think that they are white. You don't want Hispanic children to think that they are white, because when you deny who you really are and you have to be someone else to fit in to an all-white environment, that takes a psychological toll. And so you want your child. And so, you know, I hear black parents saying, oh, my God, my son is marrying a white girl now, but what do you expect? He's gone to all-white schools all his life. And it's not that they don't like the fact that they're marrying a white girl. It's that that's not been the norm in black families.
Or there's, it sounds like there's just a piece of identity that can get lost with integration.
Yes.
That you're expressing.
Yes, absolutely. Because the rude awakening is that when you go out to the real world, you are not white. And so you have to be able to have support systems and be in touch with your own community and your own identity, because you're at great peril if you don't. I think the other point that was brought up, I know at UMKC, we believe we're preparing students to become global players in a marketplace that's global. And so that is one benefit to white students of integration, is that when you grow up in, let's say, Polo, Missouri — I love Polo, no offense to my Polo friends — but you've never seen a black person until, you know, you're in high school, that puts you at a disadvantage if you decide to go to college and work for a global company. So there is learning that goes on by being exposed to people who are different than you.
Do you think, I mean, when you think about just racial injustice, racial tensions, people having all kinds of implicit bias, which is something that we've talked about a lot on this show, do you think that the lack of opportunities at a young age for people to be coming into contact with people of other backgrounds, of other races, is part of that? I mean, it just seems to me that so much in a segregated society, so much of your information comes from TV shows or, you know, sources that aren't meant necessarily to educate.
Well, and certainly when you look at something like implicit bias, where does it come from? I mean, it's wired in your brain to be defense mechanism to protect yourself about with anything that's different. But the other thing that shapes implicit bias are your experiences, incidents that have happened in your life. And so if you have no experience with people who are different, we know that bias causes us to like and gravitate toward people who are like us and to see people who are different than us in a more negative light. And so what do? When we hire people, then we hire clones of ourselves, instead of saying, you know, let's look at somebody different who can bring a different flavor. We know that groups make better decisions when there are diverse voices, even though the deliberations may take a little longer with a diverse group. But the decision and the work product is much better because you don't have groupthink.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we will be getting to your calls after this break. This is a discussion about diversity in public schools. Is it a goal that's important to you or not? Tell us why. 816-235-2888. We want to hear from you. You can call us or tweet us. We're at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about race in Kansas City's public schools. For a long time, people have generally held up integration and diversity as good things, particularly for children of color, but an increasing number of people see that line of thinking as just not working for their communities. So is that because the integration of schools is a dream that hasn't been realized in a productive way, or is it because the goal should be something different altogether? Call 816-235-2888 to chime in. I've been chatting with KCUR's Ellie Moxley, UMKC's Susan Wilson, and a parent, Gabriel Munoz. We're going to hear from a couple of our callers, and then we'll bring in some other guests on this. I want to talk to Aaron calling from Lee's Summit. Hi, Aaron. Okay, we will not talk with Aaron. I'm going to talk now with Henry. Henry is calling from Overland Park. Good morning.
Good morning. My suggestion is that we try to shuffle the deck somewhat. If we have a deck of cards and one person has predominantly hearts or clubs or spades, we know that there wasn't, you know, it isn't fair for one side to have one thing. So what I'm suggesting is that comfort is should not be the primary motive. Justice is what should be. So I suggest that perhaps, you know, one day a week that we mix students from religious schools, from charter schools, Kansas City School District. And in that day, they would have maybe a mixture of, say, for example, world history, sociology, psychology, you know, economics or something like that, so that they all can intermingle and see each other. And I think there can be learning lessons developed within those particular subjects.
Well, Henry.
Because I see racism taking place when, you know, you send children to a religious school or to a charter school or some private thing.
Well, let's, Susan Wilson, can you respond to this? It sounds, you know, some of the desegregation efforts of the past have involved things like busing, which in some ways sounds a little like shuffling the deck.
Well, I do like the idea. I do think the more you can get people who are different together to experience each other, that's always a good thing. Now, once a week in school districts is probably never going to happen because my teacher friends tell me they're having a hard enough time getting in the curriculum and the activities that are state mandated. But, you know, the idea of bringing kids together to experience other cultures, I think, is a very good idea. And we have to think about how what mechanisms we can use to promote that in Kansas City.
Let's talk with Jess. Jess is calling us from Liberty. Hi, Jess.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, I'd like to share my personal experience and maybe go from there just briefly. I grew up in during the desegregation that happened in the mid-70s in Boston. And I lived in across from Boston University. There was a elementary school. I was in fifth grade at the time. I'm in my 50s now. Just 5 minutes away. However, with the forced integration, they required white kids to be bused about 45 minutes away into the primarily black neighborhoods and schools, magnet schools that were out that way. Or I'm not sure what they were called, but it was difficult. My brother was also third grade. And I think the child's perspective is often lost in the shuffle. We're talking about the positives of bringing people together in the helping to level the field educationally.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you actually in Kansas City, I typically hear this story the other way around, that black students were on long commutes on buses.
Well, and I just think that looking back historically, we know that busing wasn't the best idea. Because when you're thinking about a child-first perspective, having to have kids get on a bus at 6 o'clock in the morning to go an hour away from their school doesn't make a lot of sense. And also neighborhood schools really have a lot of strength and power in terms of supporting children and families. So what I think happened, there were just all kinds of experiments about how do we get the kind of diversity in schools that we want in response to the separate but equal, but not every idea was a good idea.
And the baggage from that, Ellie, do you hear that kind of coming up in these discussions today?
Sure. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I said that, you know, Kansas City had kind of a unique remedy for, during the DSEG cases, this magnet school program. And it was because, you know, in the generation of DSEG cases that came before it, they'd kind of realized that busing wasn't a great solution. So they weren't going to mandate that in Kansas City. So I think it's one of those things where a lot of this gets back to the fact that we do have a lot of residential segregation, which means that if you live in a predominantly Black neighborhood, your neighborhood school is going to be predominantly Black. If you live in a predominantly white neighborhood, your neighborhood school is going to be predominantly white.
And that goes back to J.C. Nichols and his planned communities in Kansas City.
Let's talk to Aaron. Aaron, we were going to talk to a moment ago, and he is back. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
Good. How are you?
Not bad. I hope you guys can hear me okay. I'm at a park right now. I've resummed it. And the funny thing is, I'm like, can y'all hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. So I'm at this park, and I'm the only Black person here. Nothing but white kids, right? And I'll fast forward. I'll go back to there in a minute. So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, in Hazelwood, North County. Went to... My mom was a firm believer in public schools because my grandmother taught in the public school district in U City for 20 years. Have a lot of family members who are principals, teachers, educators. But when my brother went off to college at Mizzou, flunked out, she talked to her friends about what was the best education option for her sons, for next son, me, who she wanted to graduate from college and be successful, right? Or her definition of success. So she, saying, I always say, St. Louis is like a larger version of Kansas City. Like Pembroke Hill is like the biggest school that I know of here. That's a big private school. In St. Louis, you have like 20 or 30 Pembroke Hills, Chaminade, like MICDS. You have all these big private schools with options, right? And even though the education that I could have gotten at the larger school, Hazelwood Central, which I kind of would say is equivalent to like Blue Springs High School, it kind of reminds me of that. My mom, when we went to the orientation, she was upset at the fact that it was just so big, there was too many kids, and that it felt like it was like a cattle herd, like it was just a factory. And so that I was excited to go to that big public school, but all of a sudden, last minute, she put me in this private school called Crossroads. I don't know if you ever heard it. It's called Crossroads College Prep. An awesome school right there in the central west end of St. Louis. And just that, I went from coming home every day to having no homework, never having to read books. I don't remember reading a book from cover to cover until I got to high school. I remember like even showing up to this high school. There's only 200 kids from 7 through 12. And it just really changed my entire life because the schools that I went to in Hazelwood were predominantly Black. I only saw maybe like 10 white kids in my whole elementary and middle school that I can remember. And my neighborhood, like somebody was referring to like neighborhoods. I always say all this, I write a lot about this. I'm a poet. And it's all socioeconomic. It's not race. Race is just a way we can just easily label things. But at the end of the day, it all comes down to money. So right here in Lee Summit, you have a large property tax base. It's all based on property taxes. So the more money that people are paying into the system, the better the schools are going to be, the better you're going to be able to, people are going to automatically want to move to those areas.
Well, Aaron, I'm going to thank you so much for your call and enjoy that park. That sounds good to be at a park right now, but I'm going to go to another guest right now who we haven't introduced yet, who might be able to shed some light on this. Dr. Susan Eaton is with us. And Susan, you know, you've written 3 books on diversity and education. So I'm hoping that you can maybe give us some perspective on what we just heard from Aaron.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just really appreciate this conversation so far. It's been really fascinating. And to the extent that I can really add anything, it's great to hear about people's personal experiences and their perspectives on this. But in terms of what Aaron is talking about, yes, that is his experience actually is quite common, unfortunately. And one of the things that we still know is true, and one of the things that keeps me interested and concerned about this topic and being an advocate for creating and sustaining integrated schools that are actually equitable schools and the types of schools where African-American kids and other kids of color aren't forced to give up their identities and assimilate in ways that they were in the past is the fact that because of the link between race and poverty that the last caller was just speaking about, and because of the history of racial discrimination in our country, there is a huge link between race and poverty, and there is a legacy of housing segregation and school segregation in our country that's been maintained by government action and by private actors who've been subsidized by government. Right now, we have a situation where millions and millions of children of color, the vast majority of them from poor families, forced to attend high-poverty schools. Not all high-poverty schools are bad, as Susan was talking about, or not, and it has nothing to do with the fact that they're, quote, all black schools. That's not the issue, but what we do know from over a half century of research is that high-poverty schools tend to carry far, far more challenges than schools that are more socioeconomically diverse.
Susan,
and so that creates, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
I mean, I just want to jump in and ask you, I mean, you have done research on outcomes looking at diversity in education, looking at integration, and I'm curious what you can tell us about those outcomes.
Yes, absolutely. And so what we know from a half century of research is that in terms of achievement, that all students tend to do much better as measured by test scores in schools that are racially and socioeconomically diverse. And this accords with test scores. Achievement gaps are actually much smaller in these schools, and that's because of the higher relative scores of Black and Latino students, not because white students' scores happen to be lower in these schools. And also things like 21st century skills. And Susan was talking about this earlier as well, is the fact that we do know from reams and reams of studies that things like cooperation, empathy, working with others, understanding an issue or a problem from another person's perspective, complex problem solving.
And this is true for no matter who the student is?
That's right. And that's a benefit that's for all racial backgrounds. And it's important to point out that, and Ellie made some really good points about the commodification of Black children, and I think that's important. And also what I think is important to point out is that this isn't about white students making the schools better. It's about it's actually the diversity that makes it a better condition for learning these types of skills that are so important for the 21st century.
I'm going to jump in because we don't have a lot of time, and I have, I think, an important question for you. I mean, we've also heard about specific integration efforts that didn't seem to leave people feeling very satisfied. And I'm curious about ways to do integration wrong and kind of like new thinking on maybe how to do it right.
Yes, I think that's really important. And Susan and Gabe and Ellie all made really important points about that, is that the modern movement now for school integration, supported by groups like the National Coalition on School Diversity, for example, understand that diversity does not equal inclusion and diversity doesn't equal equity, that it's as important to make sure that what happens in those schools doesn't force children of color to have, first of all, unequal access to curriculum, unequal access to opportunities, and also doesn't force them to assimilate to these white norms, which are oftentimes invisible in these predominantly white environments, that really good integration efforts really challenge the status quo in that way and offer opportunities across the board equally to everybody.
Well, Susan Eaton, professor of practice and social policy and director of the Stillman Center for the Advancement of Philanthropy at Brandeis, thank you. We've got to take one more break, but there is still time to get in on this conversation. How big a priority is diversity in Kansas City's classrooms, and how big a priority should it be? I'm Gina Kaufman. We are back with a conversation about race in Kansas City's classrooms on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with lots of guests, KCUR's Ellie Moxley. Hello again.
Hey.
Susan Wilson, UMKC Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion. Hello to you.
Hello again.
And we've got two parents here with their perspectives. We have heard already from one of them, Gabriel Munoz. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And now I want to talk to Lisa Gooden. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
What is? Tell me your story. How did you come to be someone who's an active participant in the conversation about race in Kansas City public schools?
I think the way my education was growing up was not something I really thought about until I was an adult with parents with children of my own. I grew up in Indianapolis public schools in integrated schools, but they were tracked, meaning the gifted programs and the magnet programs were predominantly white. So while I had an integrated school experience, there were many of my classes that were not. And for me, that was normal. And so when I grew up and had children of my own, I started to think, why was that normal? And what does that mean? And when we were looking at schools for my own children, when they were entering kindergarten, we visited several schools and they all seemed like quality schools. And we took some good advice from a teacher friend of ours who said that most students will do well in a variety of educational environments. And so I felt at ease choosing a very diverse public school for my son, which was close to the house, but predominantly Hispanic and Black, and my children are white. And so I became an advocate for the school district at that point, a KCPS parent now for 8 years. And I would promote the schools in my community and give information about these schools. And what I was finding that a lot of my white privileged peers were actively or passively avoiding schools where the majority of students enrolled were a different demographic than their own.
So actively versus passively, can you describe the difference between those things?
Well, I would say very few white parents would say that they're avoiding a school for that reason. So I would say that they use words like test scores or good school or finding the best school for my child versus.
And do you hear that as code?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, the families that are in my peer group were choosing the same schools over and over. And some of that is passive in that, where do we get that information? Well, we get it from our social circles on the playground, in the playgroups. And if all of my friends are going to this school and all of them are saying bad things about that school, well, I'm internalizing that information without actually making a decision on my own.
So if test scores wouldn't be some sort of objective measure of what is a good school, how would you encourage someone to think about looking at schools in a way that maybe helps them break free of their own bias?
I think touring schools is one of the best ways. I would encourage families to tour multiple schools and make sure you're touring schools that have a demographic that is different than your own to really get a feel for what that school is like, because I think looking at the test scores alone or the racial or socioeconomic makeup of the school alone is not indicative of the quality of that school.
Do you think that diversity is something that people just shouldn't be afraid of, or do you think that diversity is a good in and of itself?
Both. Absolutely both. I've done a lot of research as well, and I agree with what the other people have said here today, that achievement can be raised for all students in a diverse environment. And so I feel like it's very important to not only have that as something you think about going to a diverse school, but also to have it be a goal of diversifying the schools, not just one school, but citywide.
Ellie, this passive kind of avoidance of predominantly Black schools often on the part of white parents, that's something that you've talked about before and taken some bold stances on before.
You know, I think this is one of those things where you do hear a lot of coded language. For example, we were talking earlier about, you know, this intersection between race and poverty. And we know that families that are living in poverty, they are less stable. They are moving frequently. They are changing jobs or unemployed. They are experiencing things that create trauma in the lives of their children that they then take to school, that they then have to, you know, cope with, that teachers have to handle. A lot of the ways that presents is, for example, classroom disruptions. Students in high poverty schools who come to school hungry, who come to school with, you know, they might not know where they're sleeping that night, they're more likely to act out in class. That happens. And, you know, so sometimes what we're hearing are things that, you know, sound like, oh, I want my kid to go to a school where there aren't those disruptions, where there aren't those distractions. And
or parent involvement can be used as a measure.
It can be. And again, you know, it makes a lot of sense to me as someone who spends all day looking at this stuff that, yeah, if mom's working two jobs and trying to support her family, she's not going to have as much time for the PTA as a you know, two-income household with, you know, two parents who are college-educated and work, you know, traditional 8-to-5 jobs and have a predictable work schedule and have access to paid time off. So, you know, all of those things, they kind of snowball. They're factors that end up being part of it. And, you know, I'd kind of like to echo what I think Lisa's teacher friend told her, which is that, you know, your kids can succeed in a variety of different environments. And the best predictor of how your kid is going to do in school is how much you care about education. If you really care about education and you're willing to work with your child to get the best education possible, your kid can succeed pretty much anywhere you send them.
Let's talk to a teacher who has called us up. We've got Nate and Lee Summit on the line. Hi, Nate.
Hi. I'm actually a school counselor, and I spent 3 years in Kansas City Public Schools. Loved every minute there, loved the students. A lot of highly qualified and really motivated instructors to bring education to students. But when we look at diversity in the public education forum, particularly in the urban core, I mean, I think it's important to note that there are schools in Kansas City that have 50 or 60% of their students who are actually ESL students, English as a second language, and even so much that 20% maybe are SLIFE students or severely limited and interrupted formal education coming from countries across the planet. And the school I worked at had 47 languages spoken in the building, and it raises another bar. Even when we talked about what the last speaker mentioned, test scores and how those can be looked at objectively, well, they can be looked at objectively, but not if you're not looking at the context of that building. Because a student who came into this country knowing zero English is then expected within a year or two to take an English 10 end of course exam, and that school is then graded based on that student's performance. Well, that's a biased measure. So it's just it's so many different facets.
Yeah, I think Susan Wilson wants to jump in.
And I'm glad you brought up test scores because they have been the litmus test for years about achievement. But we know that different cultural groups don't always score high on standardized tests. I mean, I'm a poster child. I mean, when I took the SAT, my scores weren't blowing up any charts or anything. But I graduated with honors from college and went on and got three other degrees. And so test scores aren't always a prediction. A predictor. I realize that that's what school districts use to really show that they're a good school. I think there's other built-in biases in schools. We talked about gifted programs. We know that African-American and Latino children, for whatever reason, even when they are gifted, get under-recognized and not put in gifted programs. And we know the same thing for out-of-school and in-school suspension, that black and brown children somehow get into those programs at a higher rate without the even interventions that they need to change their behavior many times. And that's changing, but many times that's the case.
And Missouri is one of the states with some of the largest disparities between the discipline of white students and students of color.
I want to just very quickly hear from Linda in Kansas City, Missouri. Linda, we have just very short time, but what is the basic point that you want to chime in with?
Okay, the point I wanted to chime in with was I think we as adults look at diversity in a different way than children would look at diversity. Children, I'm 71 years old, and I've learned that children work out their own diversity problems. If adults would just give positive input, and the positive input has to come from the teachers and the administration, and not only that, if I was a parent, I would, and determining a school to put my kid in, I would be looking at the administration.
Okay, Linda.
What they think, and also the teachers.
The music is coming in, and I do want to give Gabriel Munoz the chance to respond to this, because Gabriel, it doesn't sound like the diversity issues got worked out for you as a child.
Not quite. Just as a last statement, diversity is so important, and if you're out there and you're listening, please keep this in mind, because the more you're exposed to whatever it is, you will learn from it. And when you learn from something, you can teach it to the people, the future generations.
Wow. Well, our time flew by, but I want to thank everyone who participated in this discussion by calling or by being here as a guest. So Gabriel Munoz, best of luck as you navigate this with your 10-month-old.
Thank you.
Lisa Gooden, Kansas City Public School mom and member of the District Area Council Board, I appreciate your take.
Thank you.
Ellie Moxley, KCUR education reporter.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
And Susan Wilson from UMKC.
Thank you.
You can check out the whole conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard, and tomorrow is a portrait session. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.